Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Joining us tonight for Motor Talk, though, is Josh Dowling, who's the National Motoring Editor of News Corp. That must be quite a job. You must get to drive lots of cars, Josh.
Well, yeah, it's kind of comes with the territory these days. So it's, it looks like it's all about Ferraris and Porsches, but mm-hmm. I actually genuinely, and people do find this hard to believe, I actually really enjoy driving hatchbacks and utes and basically what we all drive. It is a very privileged position to drive some of these fancy cars, but I've got to tell you, there's two great feelings. The first one's getting it, but the better one is handing it back because it's so stressed the whole time. Worried if someone's going to hit it or scratch it. Yeah.
Have you ever had any sort of accident while you've been taking a test drive out? Not necessarily on a prestige car, but just any car?
Oh, touch wood. Look, we drive anywhere from 200 to 300 cars a year, and unfortunately, you might take a bit of bark off a wheel or scrape a bumper. It's something you really should avoid. I certainly treat the cars like mine, so I feel terrible if anything happens. But mm-hmm. the object of the exercise, of course, is to not do that, not test out the safety systems the wrong way.
Yeah, right. So what have you been driving this week?
Well, this week I've been getting myself acquainted with a new Lexus soft rotor. So it's a terrible term we've adopted from the Americans, but basically if you imagine a high riding hatchback in the shape of a Lexus, that's basically what you've got. And it's just yet another sign of how we are filling all these niches. So it's no secret in Australia, you can see it in the traffic. We've got a massive appetite for SUVs, appetite for utes, and almost conventional hatchbacks and sedans are a little bit passe. And what's fascinating is it doesn't cost car makers really any much more to make a hatchback that looks a bit taller. They can call it an SUV, put some chunky tyres on it, put some cladding on the bodywork to make it look a bit more adventurous. So the car industry actually loves the whole SUV craze because they can charge about $4,000 or $5,000 more for a car because it's sitting a few inches higher off the ground. Really, that's what it is. In fact, there are numerous examples where conventional hatchbacks are actually roomier than their SUV siblings.
This is the thing. I find it so irritating with, and this is because I'm a hatchback driver, little hatchback. And I don't have children or anything, but I do have a car seat for my nephew because I take him around a lot. So it's set up like it's a little family car. But the amount of times I go to the supermarket or something like that and I'm hedged in by SUVs, you can't get out properly, you can't get the baby out properly, any of those sorts of things. And I think, what do we really need them for? We're all in the city. Like, this is in the city. I understand why you might need one if you go off road a bit or if you're on dusty roads or the like. I mean, do you think there's too many of them around or am I just being a bit bar humbug?
No. Josh? Look, I see where you're coming from completely. One of the interesting thing is we seem to feel that if it's an SUV or it looks like a recreational vehicle, it somehow means we can escape the city whenever we want to. Yeah. That's what it's basically telling your neighbours. It's like, you're stuck in a hatchback or a sedan. Oh, look at this. I've got a bit of extra ground clearance and some grey bumper bars, so I can go maybe on a dirt trail occasionally. And, of course, we never do. But the practical reasons SUVs are popular, that little bit of extra ride height does give you better visibility in traffic. Mm-hmm. And I notice that when we come from SUVs down to regular, height passenger cars. Yeah. So you do notice that. And as we get older, it's easy to get in and out of a car with a slightly taller seat. So mm-hmm. with our aging population, that's another driver behind SUV sales. Wow. And young families also have embraced them because they don't have to crouch in quite as uncomfortably to get the bub in and out of the car.
Yeah, that's true. There's less hitting of the heads.
That's it. It doesn't have to bend down as much pinch your back.
Yeah. So let's get started with January, February, March. It's apparently a really good time to buy a car, Josh.
So normally this time of year is in sort of November, December, the car dealers are trying to get rid of the 2018 mm-hmm. stock because obviously we now import all our cars, and because of factory shutdowns, et cetera, over the break, we won't start to see 2019 build cars rock up to showrooms until probably February or March. Mm-hmm. And so even though the car might be only a few months old and they tell you which month it was built, September, October, in a dealer's eyes, that car is a year old.
Right.
And so the pressure's really on November, December to move cars. The pressure's still on in January because they're looking at these 2018 cars going, I've really got to get rid of those. January and December are two of the slowest months of the year because we're all checking out and going on holidays. Mm-hmm. And then there's some other factors. So The end of March is the end of the Japanese financial year.
Ah, right.
So all the Japanese car companies have a red hot go because that's where their sales targets are pegged against.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, even if you're not a Japanese car company, if you want to compete with the other brands, you also have to think of a pretty good deal. So you've got this kind of a perfect storm where you've got some of the biggest brands inside the top 10 having a red hot go
mm-hmm.
to hit their targets by the end of March. You've got dealers trying to clear 2018 stock.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it generally speaking is a pretty good time to look
to
for a
buy a car. And our changing taste in cars, there were some surprising results in the sales figures.
Yeah, so the car industry collates its data, and we should point out it's not based on actual registrations. The figures are voluntarily supplied by the dealers in the country. To be fair, the cars can't be counted twice, but I just want to clarify that because it's under the spotlight at the moment, how they actually do report their numbers. But what was fascinating is for the first time in 21 years, Ford overtook Holden. Now, it wasn't for first or second, unfortunately. They're in fifth and sixth place. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting move, and it's more as a result of Holden sliding a little.
Mm-hmm.
The other fascinating thing is, so Ford and Holden back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they had more than 50% market share in Australia between them. So one in every two cars sold was either a Ford or a Holden, and that's how we grew up. Well, this year, 2018, Ford did its lowest sales since 1966. Holden did its lowest sales since 1961.
And crikey.
What that shows you is how fragmented our market has become, and it's one of the reasons we lost car manufacturing, because we have so many brands here. We have approximately 60-plus automotive brands sold in Australia for, say, 1.1 million sales annually. In the US, they only have 38 brands competing for about 17, 18 million sales.
Oh, my gosh.
That gives you an idea just how competitive our market is.
So the 38 brands versus the 60-plus here, is that because the US is they guard the industry very...
They do guard the industry in terms of their pickup trucks, so there are special and very hefty taxes if you try to export a pickup to the US. But also they have the economies of scale.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons we're more competitive, or we have more brands here, there are not many right-hand drive countries. So right-hand drive vehicles only account for about 25% of all cars sold globally.
Right.
So when a car company decides to build a car in right-hand drive, it costs them just as much to make in right-hand drive as it does in left-hand drive, but of course they've got to get back their investment. So they say, well, we've built it in right-hand drive, let's send it to every country on the list that's right-hand drive. And so South Africa gets them, Japan, Thailand, ourselves, mm-hmm. New Zealand, and some of our neighbours.
Right. Would you mind a couple of questions before
let's
we
go?
Yeah, great. What is the best SUV up to 35,000, Paul wants to know?
Oh, good choice. So $35,000, or say $30,000 to $35,000, really is the sweet spot in the SUV class. And I'm going to make the assumption that the listener is looking at a five-seater rather than a seven-seater. It is difficult to get a seven-seater in that price range. But look, there's some really good options. My sort of top three or four, first car I would be going to look at is possibly an odd choice, but I'll be looking at the Holden Equinox. It's a very underrated car, and therefore the prices are cheaper than what it really should be. So that's a pretty good look.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also look at a Ford Escape. It's recently had an update. Both those cars now have a five-year warranty. Just trying to think what else. I also am very fond of the new Subaru Forester, but you won't quite get into that for 35 grand. It's a bit thirsty. Servicing costs are a bit high, so I'd kind of edge that a little bit further down the list. But I think my absolute favourite out of all those in that category would be the Mazda CX-5, which 35 grand would get you the base model or the next one up from the base model with automatic in the traffic without too much haggling. So there are some really good choices. So recap, Mazda CX-5, Holden Equinox, or Ford Escape.
And thanks very much for that.
That's
and
okay.
Peter wants to know your opinion on which car is best, the 2014 to 2017 Toyota Orion or the 2015 to 2017 Holden VF Commodore?
Oh, good question. Ooh. Well, I know that the Toyota will be slightly more economical, slightly quicker, possibly more reliable. Am I allowed to say that? Well, it's my experience anyway. So, look, I'm a big fan of the locally made Commodore. I've owned several of them over the last 10 years. I just, you know what? I'm probably going to err on the side of the Toyota on this one, mainly because it's a bit of an unloved vehicle, so you're more likely to get one at a lower price, whereas the VF Commodore, there will still be some people perhaps wanting to hold on to one for a bit of history. Even though the Orion was Australian made, we don't really see Toyota as an Australian brand. So that means the prices of the Commodore are probably artificially a bit too high. So I'd probably, if you want a bargain, I'd go and look at the Orion.
Great. Let's go to Warren now from the Sunshine Coast. Hello, Warren.
G'day, Melanie. And hey, Josh.
Good evening.
Mate, you better wash your tongue. Imagine slagging off holding like that.
Well, I've owned four of them, so I don't hate them that much.
Mate, I've got a VY Commodore. It's a 5.7 litre, and it's got 500,000 Ks. It's never had the heads off it.
Wow. That's just decent. You sure it's not a Hilux in disguise?
No. Okay. It's a VA Commodore. It gets service regularly. Just keeps going, no matter what. Everything works, and it does.
That's epic.
Now, the question I got, or not so much the question, but this statement, can you explain to people what the fog lights in the lower part of their bumper bars is actually for? It's not actually for just driving at night.
Yeah.
Mate, I'm an estate truck driver, and I do 5,000 Ks a year, a week, sorry.
Yeah.
And
you get dazzled by them, and especially in the wet. So I can actually, this is a pet hate of mine too. And so basically, and police do write tickets, you'll be pleased to know. And lots of police listen to us across the country. But in most states, I don't know the exact wording of every state, but in New South Wales, from memory, it's illegal to use fog lights other than when atmospheric conditions mean that visibility is at a minimum. That's legal speak for you can only use them in fog. And go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, but people seem to have a fixation. They've got to have them. Like, I've just been past four cars. I'm
really
south of Woodburn. I've just been past four cars, and every single one's got them. I got fog lights also in the bumper, in the bull bar, lower bull bar of the truckie, but I don't use them because most modern headlights are pretty damn good. Like, we're not talking about a 1960 Holden with everybody with a, you know, just a normal filament bulb in it. Yeah, we're talking about quartz halogen bulbs, and some of them are LEDs and all sorts of things these days. Yeah. It's just, I don't know the fixation. And what the bigger hate is, you know, a lot of the, as you say, we've got 68 different brands of car in Australia. A lot of them are from European. They got the lights on the back for in the fog, you know, like
the rear fog lights, which is actually a legal requirement in Europe, believe it or not. Yeah.
Look, the trouble is they have them on here and you can't travel behind them.
No, and I think in that instance, it's people who've pressed the button not realising that they've done that. And look, all I can do is assure you that police do write those tickets. They're human just like you and me. And,
I wish they'd ride a lot more then.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they do. And look, you raise a good point. Modern headlights, modern headlight technology, especially as we head to more towards LED, we won't really need fog lights over time. So I hope, as with you, I hope it actually fades out. But be assured that they do write tickets for them.
Thanks so much, Warren. And let's go to Kathy now. Hi, Kathy. What would you like to ask Josh?
Oh, hi, Josh. I'm currently in the market for a car for my daughter. She's getting her license this year, and we're interested in spending about $9,000. We're after a manual car, just sort of after recommendations around mileage and makes that you'd recommend.
What a good mum.
Yeah, that's a very generous first car. And look, that's obviously or unfortunately not quite enough to get you into a new car, but that's certainly a lot of money to open up to a lot of choice for a very good second-hand car. So I'm going to make some sweeping generalizations and then I'll zero in on a couple of recommendations. So the trick here is to try and get the newest car that you can afford, mainly because cars get safer with each generation. And in that price range, I would start to look at Suzuki Swift, Toyota Yaris, Mazda 2, they're all made in Japan cars. They, so long as you service them regularly or according to their maintenance schedules, they should look, you know, give you many years of happy motoring. You're probably going to be looking at a car about 4 to 5 years old in that price range if you really shop around. But a couple things to look for once you decide on the car you do want to buy or you're very close or closely considering buying. Do consider getting it inspected either by whichever state you're in, either the NRMA or the RACQ or RACV. The motoring authorities in each state and territory do have pre-purchase vehicle inspection services. They're not cheap. They're in the order of $200 to $300. Alternatively, if you have a friend who is a mechanic or in the car trade, they might be able to take a close look at it. The only reason I mention that is you can occasionally get caught out, unfortunately. And so experts can put the car up on a hoist or they can crawl over it. And often what happens is they will inevitably find a problem with the car. It might be serious, it might not. Either way, they will either save you wasting $9,000 on the wrong car, or they might find a fault that you can then say to the person selling, actually, the mechanic noticed this, this, and this, and you either get it fixed before you take delivery, so you've therefore covered your $200 or $300 for that inspection, or they take the price off the car. They discount the car a bit further. So general advice, start looking for Japanese cars 4 to 5 years old, Suzuki Swift, Toyota Yaris, Mazda 2, they'd be my first picks, I would say.
Yeah. Any suggestions around mileage, though?
So the national average, according to census, is around about 15,000 Ks a year. So obviously do the maths from there. So 3 years, it's 45,000. 4 years, the car would have done 60,000. So you're probably looking at a car that's done between 40 and maybe 80,000. I think if it starts mm-hmm. to get higher than that, I'd be concerned. Couple of things, though. So a well-maintained car with a few extra kilometres would be my preference over a car that hasn't travelled very far, but when you open the service book, hasn't had the service book stamped or has had it stamped rarely. So that's the other trick, is go straight to the glove box, bring out the owner's manual, the service manual, and just have a flick through that and see how often it's been serviced.
Thanks, Kathy.
All right, thank you.
And let's go to Pam now from Unanderra. Hello, Pam.
Hello.
What would you like to ask Josh?
Hello, Josh. I am in the process of buying a Honda Jazz, and I paid the deposit last Friday, and the dealership told me that the car should be there within the week. Now they're telling me it won't be there till next week. The car has always been in Australia,
mm-hmm.
ready to, you know, be shipped to wherever it's been ordered.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if this is a legitimate thing that they can't tell me exactly when the car's going to arrive at the dealership.
I feel your pain here, because I've had this happen to me a long time ago, and I'll answer the question now, but I'll also get your details off air, and I'll chase that with Honda Australia tomorrow for you and find out which dealership has the car. But here's what might have happened. Sometimes some less scrupulous dealers, and I should say most of them are, you know, hardworking small and large business owners who try to do the right thing. But some people will take your deposit and promise you a car that they know they can't get, or they think they might be able to get. And of course, all they're really interested in when they sell you a car is getting your deposit and getting your signature on a piece of paper. Because once you've got that signature on a piece of paper, they've got you hooked effectively, because you're scared of losing your $1,000 or $2,000 deposit.
And I've actually paid fully for the car.
Wow.
Now.
Yeah, that's not fair. So this won't help you at the moment. I will help you tomorrow when I contact Honda on your behalf. But for anyone else in this situation looking to buy a car, what I get them to do now is, if it is an in-demand car, unless you can physically eyeball the car, or they can, you know, you can trust their judgment that it is in stock or it's only a week away, one tip is to, when you fill out the deposit or when you sign the contract, you actually agree with the, not just the salesperson, but get the general manager or the dealer principal, someone senior, and say, the car is to be delivered by such and such a date, or the deposit is refunded in full. And that will really get their attention, because if they are pulling a Swifty and trying to you know, tell you you're going to get a car in a week when really they know it's a month or two, you are certainly entitled to getting your money back. And it's very uncomfortable, because especially if you've gotten out of a trade-in or one of the other techniques, of course, is they stretch it out and you go back with your trade-in in a month's time and they say, oh, the market's changed, your trade-in's worth $1,000 less now, as an example. So just be very, very careful. I'm sorry to hear you went through it, but for anyone else who's about to buy a car and they're concerned that it's not sitting there in stock. I mean, it is very common for dealers to swap stock among themselves. It is very common for a car to be a few days away or a week away. It does take them a few days to prepare it for delivery. But something doesn't sound right. There are plenty of Honda Jazzes around. To my knowledge, it's not a car that's in short supply, even particular variants. But I'll chase that up for you, and I'm sorry you had that experience.
Frank's on the line, Josh. Hello, Frank.
G'day, mate. Just to, this was wasn't a question. I'm just talking about that lady there about Hondas. Mate, I just bought a brand new Honda a couple of months ago, and I won't stipulate the firm, but it was in the Hunter Valley, and maybe the lady might have made some changes to her, you know, when she first bought, and which I did, and I was going to get my car within a week, and just was doing a few extra changes. It ended up being 2 weeks, but this particular firm in the Hunter Valley was a major Honda. Sales up there were brilliant as far as I'm concerned, but anyway, getting off the subject, what I was actually asking about when you're saying that there's so many different styles of car, makes of car in Australia, and we probably shouldn't have, and we lost our major makes in Australia with Holden, Ford and Toyota. It was all basically caused because of the Ford Labor Party opening up the free trade borders to anybody that can bring a car in here. I just want to know your response on that.
Well, it's fair to say both sides of politics contributed to the decline of the car industry over several decades because they both agreed to reduce import tariffs gradually. And basically, as that happened, you could just look at it on a graph. You know, sales of locally made cars went down. It gave imported cars a price and an equipment advantage. They were often cheaper, better equipped, or both. And so I don't know that you can pin it on one particular political party. And it is... It's like, unfortunately, it's a bit like an air crash disaster. It wasn't any one particular factor. So we do have comparatively high labour rates, but I don't begrudge anyone earning a decent day's pay to sit in a hot factory sweating it out to assemble cars. The difficulty is we're surrounded by countries or developing countries that have labour that's about one-fifth of ours. And they're prepared to obviously, offer government incentives to have car companies come there, set up their factories, and help them develop a middle class. So I don't think you can blame it on any particular political party or any one element. It was a whole bunch of factors, unfortunately.
Frank, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to move on to Susan now. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Melanie. Hi, Josh. Thanks for taking my call.
Look,
I'm in the market for an SUV. We're just going to get rid of a Mitsubishi Magna that's done 600,000 Ks in 20 years.
600,000,
wow. That's quite amazing. Look, my husband and I, we've looked at the Renault Koleos, the Kia Sportage and the Mazda CX-5. And hearing your earlier comments about the Equinox, I'm just wondering if... Josh, you could give me some advice about the Koleos and the Equinox because they're perhaps two that we might favour. My husband wants a bigger boot space.
Yep.
I'm happy for a smaller vehicle, but so we're at a bit of a stalemate. So anything you can give me that I can pass on.
It's really difficult, isn't it? There's actually 26 cars in that class and you've chosen four of the best.
Look, exhausting.
A couple of things to put your mind at ease. Bumper to bumper, they're about the same size as each other. I am being a bit generalising there, but within a few centimetres, they're about the same size as each other. They do look big, but they're not much bigger than a Corolla, for example, Corolla sedan, I should say, to park.
Yes.
In terms of boot size, I don't have off the top of my head the stats, but I do know the Equinox has a very big boot. I know the Koleos has a very big boot. What were the other? You looked at the CX-5. CX-5 is also extremely good.
It's just a bit more expensive again, the Mazda compared to the others.
It is a little bit dearer, and the Mazda's a bit dearer to service as well. Look, I think you can't go wrong whichever way you go. It will really depend on the style of car you like. And interestingly, I'm normally very cautious about European cars and their long-term reliability, but the Renault Koleos is in fact made in a joint venture factory in Korea. So it's one of the better built Renaults, believe it or not. It's also got a full size spare. It's also got Apple CarPlay, which is a smartphone mirroring. So you don't have to take your hands off the wheel to to answer a call. It's also got 5-year warranty. I don't know if I've said that or not. I really am quite fond of the Koleos, especially their base model or the next one up from base. It's around the 30,000 to 33,000 range. All I would say is, if you like that car, I would not talk you out of it. I would just go and have a look at an Equinox just in case.
Yeah.
It's either what you need or maybe the price is a bit sharper.
Thank you. Does the Equinox have a full size spare?
No. And so and so that's a deal breaker for me as well. In fact, very few cars in that class have a full size spare. I can give you the shortcut there. So the Renault Koleos is one of the few, which is amazing. So it's got a big boot and a full size spare. The Hyundai Tucson has a full size spare, and the Kia Sportage has a full size spare. And I like both the Kia and the Hyundai. They are effectively twins under the skin, but with a different body, because Hyundai and Kia are sister car companies.
Right.
The advantage of the Kia is you get a 7-year warranty versus the Hyundai's 5, and other than that, they're pretty much the same. So, and that's a factory warranty. That's not an extended warranty or any kind of dealer written warranty. So, look, it's a tough choice, but I'd be, if full size spare is a deal breaker, then that puts the Equinox off the list, unfortunately. So then you're back to Koleos or the Sportage, not the Mazda, because it's also got a space saver. And then maybe if you want to have a look at it, the Hyundai Tucson.
Tucson's great. Thank
you. Good luck, Susan.
Thank you.
Good luck. Thanks for calling. And we had a text earlier in the night, actually, about full size spares, Josh, asking, saying that was this person's big issue when we had a flat on the way back from Adelaide, had to go 100 Ks out of our way to get a proper tyre.
I hate them. So they were pitched to us as space savers, and that's what they're called. They're basically a wheelbarrow tyre, these skinny, awful things.
Yeah.
And often the first time you know your car has one is when you get a flat and you open the boot and there's this yellow piece of steel looking at you going, what is that? I hate them. The car industry has embraced them. They say to save weight and therefore better fuel economy. Let me tell you, it's 20 kilos. You'd have that. There'd be sales reps out there that have that in pens and lying in their door pockets and whatever other junk they've got.
Which companies then have the full size spares?
It does vary.
Right.
So even from model to model. And we mentioned Kia and Hyundai there, and they're one of the last to hang on to it. Toyota was one of the last to hang on to full size spares. They too are losing the battle with their parent company.
Yeah.
So a lot of the latest Toyotas have a space over that said. So for example, the Corolla base model has a full-size spare, and that's one that's favoured by private buyers and fleets. But if you want one of the fancy Corollas, you get one of these horrible wheelbarrow tyres.
I've got a Yaris, and I had one of those
the full-size?
No.
Yeah, so you've got a new Yaris, because the old Yaris had a full-size.
Right, and you don't notice until
it's too
you've
late.
Got a flat and you have to,
So I hate them. So the simple rule here is if you're going to buy a car, look in the boot. Actually see it with your own eyes. And if you really do need, if the car you want does only come with a space saver, you can explore the possibility of buying a spare wheel and tyre that fits that car, either on eBay or maybe the dealer has one around. You may lose some boot space. The boot floor might come up a little, but it's not an impossible obstacle to overcome. Where we will end up longer term is run flat tyres. So more and more car companies are introducing run flat tyres, so there's no spare in the boot at all. The downside is run flat tyres are dearer. They're not quite as comfortable to drive on. They're harder to replace. If you get a puncture, you can't repair them. So they're not quite perfect yet. And the main reason we have space savers is to save car companies money. They're definitely not doing it for us. They're doing it for them because, putting one of these, skinny tires in the boot is a lot cheaper than putting a pop one.
Oh, they're so irritating.
Yeah.
And it just takes over your life for the week until you sort it out, doesn't it?
And so here's the other issue. Australia is very unique because of our vast distances between regional centres. Mm-hmm. They don't have those problems in Japan and Europe
where
these
space savers
were invented effectively or where they've been embraced because they've only got to go 10 minutes down the road to a tire shop. It's much more difficult here.
Josh Dowling is with us. He's the National Motoring Editor for News Corp. And we're talking about, cars. So if you've got a question, do text in, do call in. I've got a great text here from Joe who says, I'm a university student having to travel 800 kilometres from home to uni for the year. I just crashed my good ute and looking to buy a cheap, reliable small car for the next year until I buy another good ute. What would you suggest?
Yeah, so first thing, luckily he's not trying to buy a good cheap ute because there's no such thing. All the tradies snap them up because they're on apprentice wages, they're earning money and they just want to treat themselves to ute. So luckily he's not looking for a good cheap ute. That's the hardest question to answer. But look, the answer is going to be similar to the caller from earlier in the evening and I'm not quite sure what your budget is, but certainly if you can drive a manual, that'll save you a couple of $1,000 because unfortunately fewer and fewer young drivers are getting their license in a manual these days, which means it's a lot harder for people to sell a manual. And so therefore, if you can drive a manual, that'll save you a couple of grand on the way in. Of course, the downside is when you go to sell it, you'll also face the same difficulty. And look, sweeping generalization, but yeah, Japanese, Toyota, Mazda, Suzuki, that'd mm-hmm. be my sort of first three preferences in the small hatch class.
Right. It's interesting. I just want to ask you something about the learning on the manual learning versus learning on the automatic. You know, there's one school of thought that's learn on a manual, then you can drive anything. My father, though, brought all of us up saying he'd teach us on an automatic because driving was just so hard as it was trying to, you know, when you're first in a car.
I relate to that.
Yeah, trying to sort of, that can come later when you've got confidence on the road, when you know the road rules, all that kind of stuff, then learn the manual. What are your thoughts on it?
I agree with him. So I actually taught a family member to drive in the last year or so. We did the first 30 hours in an automatic because for exactly that reason, mm-hmm. there's just so much information to take in and we wanted to get familiar with what to look out for. And you know, unfortunately, it's like a computer game where there's all these things coming at you, except it's real. Like they're real cars, real pedestrians, real cyclists to look out for. And so once we got proficient at that, then we introduced the manual. And that was just like massive overload. So we kind of did 30 hours automatic, 5 hours manual, and then we alternated between auto and manual after that because it enabled them to open their mind. Once they weren't worried about what gear to be in, they were back in the automatic and they could soak up much more information that in the traffic that they hadn't noticed before. But look, it's a dying art. It's a shame. There will very, very soon be no need to learn to drive a manual because, of course, as soon as we start getting to more electrified vehicles, they're all automatic. They're one gear. Mm. Your dad was onto it.
That's interesting.
It's a smart tip.
He'll be so happy about that, actually, because I think that, you know, we're from a country town. And so he probably got a bit of shtick from that because, you know, when you're in a country town, it's a badge
manual.
Of honour, too, to be able to drive manual.
Well, what I love about country towns is you have got so many remote areas where you can practice. You know, you've got so many empty roads or dead end roads where you can bunny hop the manual for a while. And of course, if you've got access to a paddock, well, that's just heaven, isn't it?
I tell you what, kids that have to learn to drive in the city, what a nightmare.
Yeah.
I really feel for them. call in if you've got a question for Josh. We've got Frank from Clayton, Victoria on the line. Hi, Frank.
Josh, I've got a question you about the Toyota RAV4.
Yes.
Now, with that car, how does it compete with the others on the market?
Yeah, Toyota RAV4 is a good car. And in fact, the prices on that car at the moment are astoundingly cheap for a Toyota. Mm. It's still not the cheapest in the category, but they're very, very sharp. And the reason for that is there is a new RAV4 just around the corner. So unlike phones, where a new model comes out every 12 months, the car industry has a model cycle of about 5 or 6 years. And so they have an update at sort of the 3-year mark where they'll put a slightly different bend in the bumper and they'll make a screen in the dash a little bit bigger. But the full model changes happen every 5 or 6 years. And so that's the point we're at with RAV4. So if you buy a RAV4 in a showroom today, you're effectively buying the 5-year-old model or the latest version of the 5-year-old model. But if you wait 2 months, you'll get the brand new, all singing new from the ground up RAV4.
So the features on the RAV4 now, the safety features, what have they got on it now?
So the high series cars, unfortunately, in the case at the moment, have most of the safety features, whereas the low series car misses out on basics such as automatic emergency braking. But that will change with the arrival of the new model. So every new Toyota released in the last two years that has been a full model change, safety has not been an option. Toyota has put every available piece of safety tech on every car from the cheapest to the dearest model. That will be the case with the new RAV4 that turns up in a couple of months' time. It's not the case with the ones in showroom. It's still a safe car. It meets or exceeds our government standards. It performs well in independent crash tests. The ANCAP Crash Test Authority, you can go to ancap.com.au and you can see how well it crash tested in that.
So when will that be out, the new model will be out?
2 or 3 months.
2 or 3 months. Yes.
Thanks, Frank. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Eddie now from the ACT. Hello, Eddie.
Yes, I'd like to find out how objective the Dogs and Lemons Guide is to cars. It seems to be quite critical of sub cars. What's your feedback on that?
Well, it's written by a friend of mine, Tony Davis, so I'm completely biased. But you do understand it is a bit of fun as well. So what Tony Davis has done is basically he's done a couple of books now where and it's like those small size books, the size of a cube. You often see it near the cashier at bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's designed to find some of the eccentric automobiles around the world, and it's not really designed to upset people, but it obviously does tread on a few toes here and there because, unfortunately, not all cars are perfect. And look, all I'll say to you is he's a superb writer, has amazing depth of knowledge in cars, and I'll just say read it again and take it with a grain of salt. He's just having a bit of fun.
Thanks, Eddie. And let's go to David. Hi, David. David from Melbourne, are you there?
Oh, yes. Good evening.
Good evening.
Josh, I'd appreciate your help if possible. I've been in the motor game for a number of years, and I've got a warranty problem with a major manufacturer. 5 years warranty.
Yep.
The car was off the road for three days during its warranty period with some factory update. At 5 years and 1 day, so it was technically still in warranty.
Of course.
It blew a motor.
Oh, wow.
The motor had done 104,000. It had been meticulously serviced.
Yep.
The guy who owns it is also in the motor game, and he's just one of those meticulous guys, keeps his car really clean and looks after it.
Yep.
I've just been given the total runaround. The ACCC say this is absolutely statutory warranty. You can't get past the customer service for these clowns.
Can I just ask what brand it is?
Do you want me to take?
Hyundai,
iLoad.
Okay. So, look, I'm happy.
And they've got a classic problem with a lousy engine.
Yeah. So, look, I'm happy to take your details off air and I'll to take that as homework tomorrow and I'll contact them on your behalf and get them to call you. It is unusual that you've had that experience. It's not reasonable for an engine to fail. That's an engine that's been well maintained. It's not reasonable for that to fail in 5 years, whether it's 5 years and 1 day or 6 years and 1 day. The test under Australian consumer law for the ACCC is it fair and reasonable?
Exactly.
Yeah, is
exactly.
It fair and reasonable for that engine to expire at the 5 year mark?
And the Conrod, which is not uncommon.
Yeah. So look, I think you've absolutely got a case to answer. I think Hyundai would be horrified if they knew the true situation. What often happens, and obviously I'm going to speak in very general terms now so no one gets sued, but what often happens is sometimes the dealers might be inclined to not push it as a warranty claim because they actually get paid slightly more as a labour rate if it's a retail repair. Whereas if it's a warranty repair, they have a slightly lower labour rate. But that's not your problem. That's their problem. I reckon we can get this fixed for you if you give me your details.
Warranty, but the problem is you can't get past customer service. You can't.
Well, that shouldn't be happening because that's what I what I normally tell people is once you get to customer service, they normally help you. We also do call them customer resistance in the trades because sometimes they're not supposed to be customer assistance,
they flatly refuse to get involved. So too bad.
Yeah. Well, we'll have a look at it for you if you like. If we get your details off air.
Yeah. So stay on the line, David. Suzanne will get your details. Thank you. And we've got Mark on the line from Brisbane.
Yeah, g'day, Josh. Mate, I'm just in the market for a small to medium-sized car, and at this stage I'm being swayed towards the Kia Cerato because of the value and the features. Is there any downside?
No. So the only thing I'd say is just get the Actually, the automatic does have it. So you don't need – the great thing about the Serato, as with the most recent Toyotas, you don't need to buy the top model with all the bells and whistles. So I think you can be in a Serato sedan for around about the $22,000, $23,000 mark with automatic emergency braking and all the airbags you could ever need, five-star safety, seven-year warranty. So it is definitely one of my picks. I would also take a look at – what else would I look at? See, in that price range – with that level of safety, there's nothing really comes close. There's some hatchbacks that have AEB for around that money. But, yeah, I think you've done your research well there. I wouldn't be steering you away from that.
The only thing is I wouldn't be better off waiting and having a look at the new Mazda 3 that's due out, eh?
Oh, good question. So it's not going to be soon. I think the new Mazda 3 is
mid-year.
That's right, mid-year. So, if you can wait, why not? But here's what I will guess, or it's an educated guess. It won't be as cheap as the Serato. So Mazda already has a bit of a slightly premium price. They tend not to do bold driveway advertising on their website. So you'll be paying $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 more for the equivalent Mazda. What we do know is when the new Mazda 3 turns up, it will have the full suite of safety tech from the bottom up. In fact, the current one also does. It just the one that's coming out in a few months' time will have more advanced versions of this technology. So, look, you can't really go wrong either way. You could consider a Mazda 3 in runout and save yourself a few thousand dollars and maybe pick it up for the price of a Kia, or wait for the brand new Mazda and pay a little bit more. But it's like those people who queue around the block for a new smartphone.
Yeah.
You don't really get sharp discounts in the first sort of 3 to 6 months of a brand new car.
I understand, but you've got no concerns with the new Kia, right?
Not at all. No, I own two Hyundais. They're Kias underneath as well. And I've owned Toyotas for 20 years prior to that. So I put my own money in Hyundai or Kia cars, no question.
Well, that'll do me. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay.
And bye-bye. And we've got a text from PJ at Blackmans Bay, Josh, who says, I'm at the end of my lease on a Mazda BT50 Ute. A few people have told me the engine maker has changed companies and I shouldn't get another one. What are your thoughts?
Well, so the Mazda BT50 was a joint venture with Ford. So the Ford Ranger and the Mazda share their engine. In fact, they're made in the same production line in Thailand. What the listener is referring to there is after about 30 years of partnership, Ford and Mazda are going separate ways. So Ford announced this week, in fact, that it's partnering with Volkswagen. So the next generation Ford Ranger Ute sold in Australia will be shared with the next generation Volkswagen Amarok. That won't be till 2022. Mazda is sharing its next truck, also around the same time frame, the early 2020s, with Isuzu. And so it's quite common in the Ute market for car companies to share costs and share mechanicals, but put a different top hat on it, is what they call it. So they put a different body on it. Yeah, and the reason for that is it costs a lot of money to invest and develop and engineer these vehicles. They don't really make all their money back if they do it by themselves. So if they can halve their development costs, they can obviously make more profit. So if I was buying a Ute today, Toyota Hilux is incredible value at the moment. It's the reason it's number one for the third year in a row. Ford Ranger, they're still being a bit greedy on price. So I'd probably steer clear just for another few months until they start to discount. But one of the trucks that's often overlooked is the Holden Colorado. So the LTZ, effectively the top of the range in that lineup, it's about 50 grand drive away with auto. I don't understand why they don't sell more. In fact, Isuzu beat Holden in the Ute sales race for the first time ever last year, even though the Isuzu is an older, less powerful truck. So I'd also put the Colorado on the list.
Thanks very much. And if you want to call in, you've got a little bit of time, 9 minutes left, 1-300-800-222. That's 1-300-800-222. We've got Rob on the line from Armidale in Melbourne. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Josh and Melanie. Just a question, Josh, about the Honda Type R hatchback, the hot one.
Ah, yeah, the one that looks like a stormtrooper but with wheels.
Oh, you're Googling that.
You either love it or hate it.
That's it. Are you looking to buy one?
I am.
Yeah, look, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go and treat yourself. Just a couple of things to watch out for. So first pleasant surprise with that car is even though the tyres are such a low profile, it's a cliche to say it looks like a licorice strap, but it really does. Yeah. It does actually ride really superbly. I don't know how they do it, but it's very comfortable over bumps. Mm-hmm. I would just be a bit gentle with the gearbox, especially first to second. Now, obviously, the cars, the media drive, get thrashed, but we have driven a couple where the synchros from first to second are getting a bit tired. So if it's your car and you take care of it, it won't be a problem. And look, just be sure to negotiate on price. I think the initial sort of hype has died down a little.
Yeah.
And I think you can delete the wing, or some dealers are deleting it if they want to. But look, if you love it, treat yourself. Knock yourself out. And it's obviously now got a 5-year warranty, given that the Honda's moved to 5-year.
Thanks. There's nothing to look at in the same price range.
Well, if you want to be incognito, the Golf GTI is still a spectacular car and a little bit cheaper. So it's not quite as quick as the Honda Civic Type R. But the thing is, to get the performance from the Honda Civic Type R hot hatch, you've really got to wring its neck and really rev it out. Whereas the Golf GTI, which is now automatic only, or DSG as they call it.
I want a manual.
Yeah. You want a manual? Okay. Yeah, so the Golf's off the list then. I wouldn't dissuade you from that. If you want something smaller, we don't know when it's going to turn up, but sometime this year there will be a new Ford Fiesta ST. It's the next size down. It'll be about early $30,000, so it'll be $20,000 cheaper than the one you're looking at.
Yeah,
but that's the only other thing that I think that might tempt you.
Yep, very, very helpful. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks, Rob. And Jody's been waiting patiently too on the line. Hello, Jody.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. How are you?
Good, as you are speak up now.
Oh, sorry, I didn't catch that.
I have got a weird question. I bought a Toyota Coaster short wheelbase, BB10. 1982, last February, from Queensland, and I got a safety certificate, but no other certificates. I paid $15,000 for it from a site that I was on Facebook for 2 years. They knew I had a stroke and I was wanting to travel on my own. But I've actually written to the Queensland Transport Board, but I'm wondering if you know, have any idea how much hope I've got of recovering my super that I fought for 10 years and paid for the bus tour because I had people saying it was roadworthy.
Yeah, it's difficult. Two questions. Did you buy the car from a dealer or a private seller?
That's it, basically.
No, you bought it from a dealer, did you?
Hello?
Did you buy it from a dealer or a private seller, Jody?
No, private seller.
Yeah, unfortunately, that will be harder to find a resolution. I would still talk to the equivalent of Fair Trading in Queensland and see what your rights might be. This is unfortunately one of the pitfalls of buying privately. So I know dealers get a bad rap because, you know,
sorry, Jody.
The dealers get a bad rap because, when you buy a used car at a dealership, it's a little bit dearer. But part of the reason for that is, well, aside from the fact that that's their business, they're there to make a profit. But they do have to warrant cars that are less than 7 years old for, I think it's 3 months in most states, sometimes a little bit longer. And so that is one of the protections you do have if you do buy through a dealer. And certainly if the car was later found to be stolen or rebirthed, or there was some finance still owing on it, or there was some other problem with it, at least you have some recourse when you're going through a dealer. But when it's with a private seller, that is very unfortunate. It's very difficult to undo. Yeah.
Good luck, Jody. And sorry we lost you. I'm not sure what happened. Let's go to Peter now from Kilmore. Hi, Peter. Peter, are you there? Hello, Peter. Peter's gone. We've got to act quickly. We've got so many calls. Lisa from Chatswood's on the line. Hi, Lisa.
Oh, hey there. I'm looking at selling my 2001 Daihatsu Sirion, and I wanted to get some advice about how much I should be asking for it. I want to give a fair price, but at the same time, I don't want to shortchange myself.
Yeah. Is it auto or manual?
It's manual. It's been well kept. You know,
what color is it?
It's white. Okay. I get it serviced every 6 months. So,
Oh, do you know what? That is an amazing car. And the next question is, how much rego's left on it?
Until November of this year.
Yeah, so that's really...
So plenty of rego.
Plenty of rego. So the sad news is it's not going to be worth a lot. And I don't like giving valuations over the radio because you do need to see the car, but it's...
Yeah.
I'm going to disappoint you. It's going to be in the order of, you know, a couple of thousand dollars if you're lucky, and part of that's going to be the rego money because it is so old. But you're really better off... it's just a shame we can't sort of connect you with some young person who's looking to buy a really good, well-maintained first car. Because in that price range, in that $2,000 to $4,000 price range, I call that the loose change of the automotive industry, because it is a real lottery what you get. You could get a gem and you could get an absolute lemon that costs you a couple of grand each year just to keep alive. I owned a Sirion. They're incredibly reliable. The reason I asked for the colour is I had a yellow one and it peeled itself in the sun. So white is definitely a good colour. I'm so pleased you've had it serviced every 6 months, and I wish I needed a car, because that is going to be an absolutely great buy. So
yeah, it is a great little car, and it's hard to get an idea of how much to ask for it. So I looked online, and some estimation said $1,500, some said $4,000. I think I'm really not sure what to ask for it.
How many Ks has it done?
263,000.
Yes, that's very high. So, look, I can take your details off air and I can call a wholesaler mate of mine, but I think he's going to tell me it's going to be worth the rego plus $500. It's almost worth keeping or giving to a family member or selling to a family member or a friend who you know, I mean, generally you don't want to buy cars from friends or family, because when it goes bad, it's a bit embarrassing at the next barbecue. But I would you've got no problems selling that car with a clear conscience, and it's just a shame we can't find some worthy young driver to get it.
Good luck, Lisa. Yeah,
well, I'll try and find them.
Thanks
for your help.
Good luck.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You know what? We've run out of time.
Oh, no.
And we haven't even had time. You had some great motorcycling news.
Do we have 30 seconds?
20 seconds.
20 seconds. Yeah. So Toby Price, Australian motorcycle rally racer. He, while we are speaking, he's about to start on the last leg of the Dakar rally. He goes into it with a minute lead after 5,100 kilometres of racing. He won it in 2016. So our fingers crossed for him. Go, Toby.
That is brilliant. Josh Dowling, it's been a delight having you here tonight.
Thank you
so much.
You're welcome.
Josh Dowling is the News Corp National Motoring Editor and has been joining us to answer your questions.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.